We're holding on page 20 in Bava Kamma, four lines from the top, middle of Oskof Gimel. We were learning, the Gemara had mentioned, the Mishnah had talked about that you can't raise small livestock, sheep and goats in Eretz Yisrael because they damage the crops and the vegetation, and that led the Gemara into discussion about various other things that are done in Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, things that the Chachamim made at Takana in order to promote the settlement of Eretz Yisrael. So we said that Rab Abba Bar Papa, said in the name of Rab Acha Bar Papa, in the name of Rab Hanina Bar Papa, a couple of dinim, which the third one of them has to do with Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. We talked about yesterday what the Maharat Chai says, a connection between the three things that he said, that both of them amount to grab the opportunity when you have it. But in any case, the third one was, so now on page 20, fourth line, Balakech buys for Eretz Yisrael. If a person buys a house in Eretz Yisrael from a guy, Koisvin Olav Oinoi, you can write a Shtar Mecher, or a deed, Afilu B'Shabbos, even on Shabbos, because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. But the Gemara asks, Shabbos, Sakadaita, what do you mean you can't? No matter what, to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or not, he still can't be Machal Shabbos for the sake of it. Ella, no, what it means is, Kedah Omer Rava Hosem, like we find that Rava says elsewhere in Shas, Oymelo Ud Gechavim Va'Oise, that there are cases where you can tell a Goy to do something and he can do it for you. Usually you have the concept of Amir al-Akum, but you have cases where Amir al-Akum is in fact Mutter, where it's a Dvar Mitzvah, where it's a Choyle Fein V'Sakana, and a number of other examples. So Hochinami, here it's the same thing, Oymelo Ud Gechavim Va'Oise. It doesn't mean you, the Yid, write the Shtar on Shabbos, but it means you have a Goy write it for you. Who, even though normally that would be awesome, the Rabbanon, to tell a goy to do something for you on Shabbos, but for the sake of promoting the Jewish settlement of Eretz Yisrael, like Gozribei Rabbanon and the Chum did not impose that Zera, and they said, go ahead and tell a goy to write you a deed even on Shabbos if that's what's needed in order to make the sale happen. And again, in other words, grab the opportunity when you have it, otherwise the goyish owner may change his mind and not be willing to sell, or who knows what, and then you'll lose your opportunity to buy back a piece of Eretz Yisrael and then bring it back into Jewish hands. Talking further about this matter of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara says, Tanan Rabbanan Asarat Tnoim Hisna Yeshua. Yeshua made 10 conditions with the Jewish people. When they first conquered and settled Eretz Yisrael, then he made these 10 Tnoim that the people are going to be living in Eretz Yisrael, and they have to agree to all of these. This is all basically a matter of some of them are to promote the growth and the population of Eretz Yisrael, others of them are to reduce friction between neighbors and shvatim and all that sort of thing. So, number one, Shiyum Marin B'choshin. People are allowed to graze their animals in the forest. So here, the Mishnah had said you can't raise small livestock in Eretz Yisrael, only under certain conditions. So one of those conditions is that you're allowed to in the forest. Because there, nobody has farms and anything, and therefore there's not such a problem with the animals there, with the animals destroying it. There is actually in Sefer Shmuel, it mentions a battle that took place between David during the time when Avshalom was revolting against David and had raised his own army to keep his kingship, and David's army meanwhile was fighting against him. The pasuk describes how there was a battle in Avra Yarden in what it calls the forest of Ephraim. Now Ephraim had their territory on the west side of Yarden. How comes there to be a forest on the east side that's called Yar Ephraim? So Rashi brings there from the Medrash based on this takana over here. Since you're allowed to graze your animals in the forest, so there was a forest on the east side of the Yarden, right across from Ephraim's territory. People from Shevet Ephraim would regularly go over there to graze their animals, and therefore it came to be known as Yar Ephraim, even though it's strictly speaking in the territory of Manasseh. So that's the first one. Number two, Malakhtin Eitzim Besadisehim. You're allowed to gather wood from other people's fields. So you don't say, well, all that wood is in my field, therefore it's mine. Other people are allowed to gather it. All of these, we're not going to have here in Ein Yaakov, but all of these, the Gemara goes into the details. It's not so simple. You can't just trespass on somebody's field and take whatever wood you want. We're talking about like thorn bushes and little slivers of wood and things like that. We're not talking about significant size branches and pieces of wood where the owner of the field himself might want them. Okay, next. So, Malakhtin Asofim B'chol Mokim. You're also allowed to gather grass from anywhere, like to feed your animals or whatever, chutz mitilton, with the exception of if it's in a field where tilton is growing, because grass is beneficial for the tilton. Tilton is, in English, it's called fenugreek. It's also known as chilbe. They use it a lot in Yemenite cooking. It's an herb. It's a spice that contains little triangular shaped seeds. Tilton literally means triangular, the Malachian tlas. So it's a spice, it's a condiment that they would commonly use it for animal food. And then the point is that where you grow it and grass grows over there, it's beneficial. It helps the tilton plant. So therefore, there you can't pick grass. Again, the Gemara goes into details. Sometimes, in fact, we find that it's the other way around, that grass growing nearby is bad for tilton. Again, the Gemara goes into the details that are not here in Ein Yaakov. Next, the next takana was v'koytmen netiyas v'chol makom. You're allowed to cut off branches from a young tree anywhere. Chutz mi, you're going to use them for yourself. You're going to use them to start an orchard of your own. Chutz mi groifius shozayis, with the exception of groifius of fig trees. Rashi explains groifius as malashon egroif, as in a fist. When you based on a Mishnah in Bava Basra. And where it talks about, also similarly there, you sell a tree to somebody, what exactly is he entitled to, and what is he not entitled to? So you have this mention over there, Shnei Groifius Cholzayis, you leave. And actually explains that you're leaving a length of two fists, one on top of the other, of the branches, that way, eventually a branch will regenerate from there. If you cut it closer than that, then it's not going to regenerate, and then you're damaging the tree. That's according to Rashi. So according to him, groifius is in Russian egroif. Tosfos brings from the Aruch that rather groifius means branches. It's just branches of some kinds of trees, of different names. The name for that that's used for the branches of olive trees is called groifius. So what it means is that you can't cut off branches from somebody else's olive tree to start growing your own olives, but you can cut off branches from other trees for that kind of purpose. Again, the Gemara goes into the details only from certain parts of the tree, and only when the tree has not been producing fruit, etc., etc. Next, the next takana of Yeshua, Umayin Hayotze Betchila, a spring that came out new, that all of a sudden water started coming out from the ground. Bnei Ha'ir Mesapkin Mimenu, the people of the city can use that water. So first of all, Rashi says what we mean is that we mean if it came out new. Alakas kama v'kama, if it was old ones, if it was an old spring that was already there when they first conquered and settled Eretz Yisrael, then everybody's allowed to use the water. The chiddush is, even if it's a new spring that just came forth, you don't say it belongs exclusively to the person in whose property it came out. The water is available to other people once it goes out of his property. But I'm phrasing it a little differently. The point is that the Bnei Ha'ir, the point is that the people of that city are allowed to use it collectively, but not necessarily the people from other cities nearby. So that's the next one. Umachakin b'yamashal Tveria. The next thing is you're allowed to fish with a rod and a hook in the Sea of Tveria, which is the Kinneret. Even though, as the Gemara points out in the next piece, the whole Kinneret actually was part of the territory of Naphtali, nevertheless, people from other Shvatim are allowed to take a rod and reel and go fish there. Ovovad kela yifris kela, as long as you don't spread out a kela, the yamid is a spinner, because that would stop boats from going. Rashi explains yifris kela is when you want to catch fish, sometimes what you do is instead of just taking, you're going to take a rod and reel and put a hook with bait or whatever and go catch fish one at a time. Sometimes instead you might want to catch a larger number of fish. So not so much a net. Rashi explains it's more of a stationary net. In English it's called a reel. What you do is you put up a bunch of stakes into the water. Then you drive a bunch of stakes into the bed of the lake, and then you hang a net along those stakes. And then that way, any fish that get into that area are trapped in there, and then you can go catch them at your leisure. So now you're not allowed to do that, because that prevents boats from going. Because then you want to have the free passage of boats, and if you have a weir set up like that, you're not going to be able to. The Nashba was a different explanation, that kela over here can also mean the sail of a boat. So in other words, you can't go start having sailboats that you're going to go fishing from there using nets. Because then you're catching, because the Euphrates Kela, the Yamanis Asfina, would mean you can't have a boat with a sail where then you're going to drop anchor someplace and take out a huge net and start catching fish, because then you're catching too many of the fish that belong to Shevet Naphtali. The next one, the nifnin la'achorei ageder, when you have a person has to go to the bathroom, you're allowed to go behind a fence. Even if the field is full of saffron, which is very expensive stuff, even a tiny amount of saffron is worth a lot, but you're still allowed to go in there. The Gemara explains that actually what it means is the chiddush is not so much that you can go behind the fence, the chiddush is that you can take a stone from the fence afterwards to wipe with, you know, this is long before toilet paper. So therefore, even though you're breaking down the fence a little bit, but you're allowed to for that kind of purpose. A point also that Mephoshim make is the point is that even though saffron, people grow it for its fragrance. It's a spice. So if you go to the bathroom over there, then the odor is gonna interfere with it. Nevertheless, you're allowed to. Next, you're allowed to walk on paths that are reshus. So Rashi describes the farmers, after they gather in their grain, Tishrei time, until it comes time to plant, which is approximately Cheshvan time, meanwhile, people, they make their fields available, people can use them for shortcuts. Those things are called Shvili HaRishus, so you're allowed to continue walking in them, agitated via Shmiya, until the second rain falls, which is usually Yud Zayin Cheshvan. So from the time when they gather in their crops around Sukkot time, which is why Sukkot is called Chag HaOsif, you have approximately a month when you can use those shortcuts freely. Other Mephoshim point out, then what's the chiddush? Yeah, if the farmers are allowing you, then you don't need a tanai for that. So rather they explain that Shvili HaRishus means paths that have always existed there. People have always used them. Now, when the field is being planted, then you still can't use those paths because the fact is that then you're going to damage the guy's crops. But now we're talking between the gathering in and the new planting season. Even though the farmer hasn't given specific permission, nevertheless you're allowed to use those shvilim, those paths that have always been there. And by the way, actually, Revia Shnia will be, the farmer has done his first plowing, and he's already planted. Revia Shnia, though, is just the time, the second rainfall around Yud Zayin Cheshvan, when the crops are going to actually start growing. So in other words, the point is, even though he's planted before that, he still can't keep people out and say, you're going to damage my crops, because nothing's damaged yet. They're just seeds in the ground at this point. So therefore, there's no problem walking through there. You can go and walk on the sides of the road at any time, even when the crops are growing, because of the pegs on the road. Rashi describes back then when the roads were mud, so summertime it doesn't rain, so the mud dries up and it doesn't dry up and smooth, it doesn't dry up smoothly. Instead it forms like little bumps all over the place that are like pegs. So it would be very hard to walk on that. During that time, instead of having to walk davka in the middle of the road, away from the fields, away from the crops, so you don't accidentally trample them, you're allowed to walk by the edges, even though you might accidentally trample a little bit of the guy's crops, in order to stay away from those yisrei sadrachim, those peg-like bumps all over the road. The next one is Atoya ben Akronim. If a person is lost among the vineyards, a person wanders, wandering around, he ended up in somebody's vineyard and he can't find his way out, Mafsig v'oyla, Mafsig v'yurid. He can cut branches as he needs to in order to get up and down, in order to get out of there and get back onto the main road. The Meiri points out he would afterwards have to pay. This is called Matzalatzim. This is called Matzalatzim and Mamon Chaveri. He's saving himself. He's getting back on the road at the expense, somebody else's expense, cutting his vines. So he does have to pay afterwards. But the point of the Takana of Yeshua is we're not expecting him to stay lost until to only have to gradually, maybe gently part the vines. He's allowed to take a machete or whatever it is and slash his way through.
Was there a mistake going in the first place?
Yeah, the pastors were talking about. He got lost and ended up in there, yeah. And the last one, a mess mitzvah, you find a body and there's nobody available to bury it, it's koine its place, meaning that you bury it right there. You don't take it to the nearest Beis HaChayim. The point of that takana being that if you're required to do that, a person might say, well, then why can't be bothered, and he just leave the body there unburied entirely. At least you allow him to bury it over there, then at least he'll do the mitzvah, he'll do that chesed, he'll emes for that mess. The The Medrash, by the way, tells a story in connection with about Rabbi Akiva about that. When Rabbi Akiva, we know Rabbi Akiva was an Amal Oretz for many years, and he started to learn Torah. Eventually, he went to the yeshiva of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. So he tells a story on himself. He says, one time I was out in the middle of nowhere. I saw a mes mitzvah, and I didn't yet know this din, a mes mitzvah kana makomer, and I carried it 4 mil to the nearest Jewish town that had a beis hakvaris. Afterwards, I went and told my rebbeim. They told me every step that you took was like shreifach dam. But since that mes mitzvah kana makomer, then you had no business moving him from where he passed away. So then Rabbi Akiva says, I realized how much I still have yet to learn. And then from then on, I stayed constantly by the side of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua to learn every scrap, every drop of Torah that I could from them. Nowadays, by the way, we don't do this. The post can point out because nowadays mostly we live in among the goyim. If we were to bury a mes mitzvah anywhere, there's no guarantee that they won't afterwards go and dig it up and do who knows what. Not always a bote kvaris safe either. That's a whole other matter. But at least to bring him to a bote kvaris, then at least there's a better chance that he'll be safe there until tzias emes, until Mashiach comes. Yeah, we're talking about it's Jewish, for Pashto say. Yeah. If you don't know, I guess you don't know, but I don't know, yeah. There is a story worth mentioning in this connection. There was a Yid in Eretz Yisrael many years ago, not at all Shem Matoto Mitzvahs, but he started having, his father passed away, and not long after that, he started having dreams where his father was coming to him and telling him to do tshuva. A bit unusual so he goes to one of the gedolim of that time. I believe it was the Chazon Ish. I don't remember. He asks him. So do you have any what did you do special? What did you do special that you deserve that you're worthy of having such a thing? Minashamayim to urge you to do tshuva. So the guy mentions this, that, and the other, and the Rav, I think it was, like I said, I think it was the Chazon Ish, tells him no. It's because many years ago you buried a mes mitzvah. And the guy remembers, when I was 14, back when I was in Poland, before he had made Aliyah with whichever group over there, one time he found a Yid's body someplace, and he carried it to the nearest Beis HaChaim to bury it. So in the schus of that, so he's told, now is why you're now you're being given a Hesoros Milamayla to do tshuva.
From the story you brought, seems like that you're not allowed to bury him.
So that's the thing. In Rabbi Akiva's times, you weren't, because in Rabbi Akiva's times, Eretz Yisrael was still mostly populated by Jews. So you can bury it in a Jew's field, and it can be expected to remain safe over there. Meanwhile, this Yid in the story was living...
He wants to take it somewhere else to a cemetery.
No, so that's the thing. But the thing is, since we say mes mitzvah kona makomer, then he has to... Bederech Chal, he has to be buried where he is. That would be his covered. But by Medvaram Amurim, when it's a Jewish field, when there's a high likelihood, therefore, that it'll stay safe over there. Mashenkin, when you're in Poland and you're living among the Goyim, you don't have that, so therefore, yeah.
Seems like it's for convenience. You find the best mitzvah, you don't have to schlep many
Goyim. Right, but nevertheless, it seems from that story of Rabbi Akiva that it's more than that. It's not just for convenience. Once Yeshua made the takana, then that's how it is. Yeah, then you have to bury him where he is. Yeah. So the Gemara goes and discusses a number of these takonis in greater detail. One of them is about this matter that we said that everybody's allowed to fish in the Kinneret, but they're not allowed to put up nets, and they're not allowed to put up weirs, and they're not allowed to trawl with large nets. So the Gemara says, Tananabana, Yamash or Tveria Bechelkesh and Naphtali Haisa. The Sea of Tveria, the Kinneret, was in Naphtali's territory. The loy oid, not only that, Elishanoto Maloy Chevel Cherem Bedroima. Not only that, but he also got a strip of land south of the Kinneret, the length of a rope. They had standard ropes in those times that they used for measuring Cherem of a place for nets. Bedroima in the south of the sea. The point is that Naphtali is allowed to use large nets over there because the Kinneret belongs to them. So now, after they've fished with nets, they need a place to dry them out. So therefore, they were given a strip of land south of the Kinneret that they can use to put their nets on the beach and dry them out. So that also was considered part of their territory. Because you don't want them to get moldy, I guess, with pashtos, whatever. You're not necessarily going to put them right back in the water. I don't know. I'm not a fisherman. I don't know how these things work. But there are times when you need to dry out your nets. We find in Hilchos Shabbos as well. Sometimes you also need to untie and retie them if they're developing holes or whatever. So sometimes you need to. Yeah. L'kayim mashenemar. This fulfills what Moshe Rabbeinu said in his bracha of the Shevet Naphtali. Yom v'doran yerosha. The sea and inherit the sea and the south. So he's telling him, inherit. You will inherit the sea of Kinneret as well as the south, as well as a strip of land south of it. So the Gemara continues, Tanya Rav Shimon Elazar. Here's another thing about which Shvatim got what. Tlushim Shebaharim. Anything detached that's on the mountains. So that when they came into Eretz Yisrael and they conquered the land, there may have been trees that were already detached there, that the Canaanim had chopped down or that fell down in storms or whatever. The Cheskas Kol HaShvatim Hem Oimdim, those are in the Chazakah of all the Shvatim. Anybody from any Shevet who passes by and finds that can take that for himself. We don't say that it's Davka, that it belongs Davka to the Shevet and whose territory that mountain is. Or mechubarim, that any of the trees or plants or whatever that are attached to the ground, becheskas oisah shevet, those have a chazaka of belonging to the shevet in whose territory that mountain is. And Rav Shimon Elazar continues, the emachokol shevet v'shevet miYisrael she'em loy bahoru v'shtelo v'negev v'me'emek. There's not a single shevet among the Jewish people that does not have territory in the mountains and the lowlands, and in the negev usually means the south of Eretz Yisrael, like in this week's parasha by Yisav Ram, holach v'nasay ha'negva, but here ha'negev means more like the prairies, the areas that are relatively drier and they're like grasslands. So every shevet has some of that in their territory over Emek and in the valleys. Shvela is the lowlands that may be very wide plains. Emek is more like narrower valleys. So Eretz Yisrael is a very diverse territory. It has a lot of microclimates, and every shevet has something of that somewhere in their territory. Shenamar, as the pasuk says, as Moshe tells the Jewish people, "Pnu sulachem, turn and travel for yourselves." Uvoyu har ha'emori, and come to the mountain of the emori, v'alkol shchenav, and all of its neighbors, va'arava, in the lowland. Arava is the valley, actually, Bahor in the mountain, or Vashvela in the lowlands, or Negev and in the drier areas, the grasslands, or Vachoyf HaYom B'Gomer and the sea coast. So we see that Moshe is telling all the Shvatim that you're going to have all these things. Marashah points out, you don't really have Ba'emek here in the Pasuk, but instead of having, you have Choyf HaYom, which maybe amounts to the same thing. So we see that he's telling all the Shvatim, you're going to come into a land which has a tremendous diversity packed into just the small area of Eretz Yisrael, and every Shevet is going to have some of that diversity. In fact, you find that with the seven nations that lived there beforehand, each one of them also, even though primarily they had one area that was their base, but each one of them also had a diverse territory like that. Because the Pasuk is saying, come to the mountain of the Amori and all his neighbors. Who are his neighbors? The other seven nations. So you see from that that all the neighboring nations, all the nations of Canaan had the same kind of thing. They all had these different microclimates and territories in Eretz Yisrael. The Medrash mentions, by the way, in that connection, that you also have in your Shalayim itself actually is a microcosm of the whole world in that sense. So it says that Shlomo HaMelech, being Shlomo, he could recognize the veins of earth that run underground from different places in the world to your Shalayim, and that way he was able to plant orchards and grow all kinds of exotic plants and trees and whatnot that normally only grow in other parts of the world. He was able to plant them in your Shalayim, in his orchards, in the place where he knew that this particular vein of earth, this particular type of earth extends underground and comes over here and is able to grow this kind of thing. But he was saying that more generally, Eretz Yisrael contains all these different types of terrain, which each one is good for growing different kinds of crops. The Gemara mentions elsewhere that you have crops that grow better in the mountains, ones that grow better in the valleys, and so on and so forth. So every shevet is able to benefit from that. Tosfos refers to a Gemara in Bava Basra that says it'll be even more so lasted lover in the future when Eretz Yisrael is redivided among the Shvatim. Yechezkel describes how instead of in the original division of Eretz Yisrael, every Shevet had a territory, but it wasn't the shape of the territory, it was just however the topography went or whatever. Yechezkel describes how there's going to be strips one next to the other, each one the same width, running from east to west. And there also, the Gemara mentions that each person, there it's not even each Shevet, every individual person is going to have a plot in Eretz Yisrael that's going to contain all these different types of terrain and climate. So again, that way every person will be able to benefit from all the different things. Talking about, we said that one of the Yeshua's takanos was that you're allowed to walk on the sides of the roads, right next to people's fields, because of yisdos hadarachim, because of these peg-like bumps that form on the mud roads during the summertime. So the Gemara tells in this connection, Rebbe and Reb Chiya habu shakli va'azli ba'orcha. One time, Rebbe and Reb Chiya were walking together on the road, and they went off to the sides of the roads, like we said, because otherwise the road itself was too bumpy for them to walk comfortably on. Meanwhile, Rabbi Yehuda ben Knussa was going and walking ahead of them, and he was walking, and then he was taking psias gassis. He was taking large steps because he didn't want to go to the sides, but on the other hand, it would be too much of a bother to go from the bumps, off and on the bumps. So he was taking wide steps to go to stretch out his legs from one bump to the other. So like this, he could walk in the middle of the road and not go to the sides, but he would be taking large steps for that purpose. So Rebbe says to Rebbe, who is that ahead of us who's showing this greatness, who's showing himself off like a Baal Gaiva, like he's being extra machmir when the halacha doesn't require it? It's a form of yuara. It's a form of like showing off, like I'm a bigger yore shemayim than everybody else. So Rav Chiya says, this might be Rav Yehuda ben Knussa, my Talmud, v'chol ma'aseh l'shem shemayim, where I can tell you everything that he does is l'shem shemayim. He's not doing it for yuara. He's doing it because he doesn't want to avail himself of these tznoim of Yeshua. So therefore, so he doesn't want to take the chance of even the tiniest chance of ruining somebody else's field.
Does he know the other people were watching?
He didn't know the other people were watching. Yeah. Sure enough, when they caught up with him, Chazia, then Rebbe saw, yes, it is Rebbe Yehuda ben Knussa. Amalei says, he loved Yehuda ben Knussa at. You know, if you weren't Yehuda ben Knussa, and your Rebbe, Rebbe Chiya, has vouched for you that you're Kol Maisa L'Shem Shemayim, Gezartinu L'Shokach B'Gizra de Parizala, I would have chopped off your legs with an axe of iron, which is, in other words, a way of saying I would have put you in Chayim. So in other words, this is not the way that a person should act. In a way of Yura, but fine, I understand from what Rav Chiya says, that you are Yoresh Shemayim, you're doing everything L'Shem Shemayim, so you have the right to do this kind of thing. But a regular person, Taka, should not, a regular person should follow the Takonis of Yeshua and not act in a way of Yura. Marashah brings another possibility as well. We find this word Gizra in connection with, in Masechta Shabbos, you have a case of an animal that naturally takes very narrow steps. You want to force it to take longer steps. So you put some kind of contraption. So you put some kind of contraption between its feet to force it to take larger steps. So here Rebbe is telling him, you know what? You as it is, you're taking large steps as it is to go from one bump to the other. I would put something on you that would force you to take even larger steps. In other words, like make it even more uncomfortable for you. Except if because you're acting in this inappropriate way. Except again, I recognize that for you, you would have been Knussa. You're not. You're doing it the same shemayim.
Did he know that the two guys?
He didn't know that they were watching him, the pastures. No, but Pashas, he didn't know. Then Yehoyada points out, you know, they themselves, what?
Like they make
judgments. Because the fact is, a person still has a responsibility not to act in a way where it's going to make people think that this is required of the halacha. In fact, then Yehoyada says, Taka, why didn't Rebbe and Rav Chiya themselves do this? Either because, number one, people might misunderstand and think that is the actual halacha, that you're not allowed to walk by the sides of the road, and the fact is, halacha as you could because of Yeshua's takanas. Also, he points out another thing. When we say that they were shakli v'azli b'urcha, means they were walking and talking together in Torah. So therefore, they can't go and start taking wide steps, and they won't be able to keep up with each other, and they won't be able to focus on their talk in Torah. Whereas Yehuda ben Knussa was walking by himself, so he didn't have that issue, so he figured he could better take the wide steps. So that person ordinarily shouldn't take psia gas. Anyhow, that's a different matter, but yeah.
Something about,
it
can make someone suspicious of what
you're
doing.
Right, right. The key. All right, you have to act in a way that everybody realizes above board, right? Okay, so the Gemara says Amri. Now the question is, Asora, what do you mean that there are 10 takonis? If you count up the takonis that it listed before, Chadz, Hani Chadzre having, and you actually find 11 takonis. And he said Yeshua made only 10. The answer is, Mahalchim Mishvila Hershus Shloima Amra. The answer is, one of the ones on the list over there was actually not from Yeshua. The fact that you can walk in the paths in other people's fields between when the grain is gathered in and Revia Shnia, and the second rain, meaning again, even after people have plowed and planted their fields until the crops actually start germinating and growing, that's actually not Yeshua's takana, that's actually from Shloima Amelach. So therefore, it's so it was added in over there because it's a takana to promote peace and the settlement of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, it was included in the list. But a taka shouldn't be in there among a list of Yeshua's takanas because it's actually from Shloima. Kedetanya, as we learn in a brisa, hadesh kolu peirosev min asada. Suppose a person's crops and fruit has already been gathered in from the field. And still he doesn't allow people to walk through his field. Mahabrius umris olav. So what do people say about such a person? They say mahano yeshloponi. After all, what is this person gaining from keeping people out of his field? Or mahabrius nazikus loy. How would anybody be hurting him? So the people are saying, you know, he's acting like midas doim. Marasho refers in this connection earlier in the Masechta, a couple of weeks back, we learned about a case, Hador b'chatzar chaveder shalemi daita, a person lives in somebody else's chotzer, where the chotzer is not meant to be rented out, and he's taking care that he's not damaging the property in any way, then he's taka not obligated to pay rent. So it's called zen man of zele chotzer. Marasho says, though, the difference is that there, we wouldn't force the landlord to keep him there. If the landlord does say, I want you out, then he would have every right to do that. Because fine, even though right now he's not renting out the place, he could change his mind any time and decide he wants to rent the place, and then you're squatting in there. So therefore we wouldn't force him, but on the other hand, he can't require the tenant, the squatter, to pay rent. He, Marshall says, is more than that. We're saying we can actually force this landowner to allow people to walk through his fields during that period from the Osif until Revi'a Shnia, because it's an example of Koifin al Midas Zoyim. He really loses nothing from it, and everybody stands to gain by having a shortcut. So all of our Kosev Omer, on this the Pasuk says, Pasuk in Mishlei, which Mishlei is written by Shlomo HaMelech. So we see that this is the Rakana of Shlomo. Mi yos tov al tikri ra. Instead of where you have an opportunity to be good, then don't have it said about you that you're bad. So the Gemara says, mi yos tov al tikri ra. There's no such Pasuk. The answer is ain. The answer is yes, not those exact words, but ksiv kahai gavna. You have the substance of it in an actual pasuk in Mishlei. Al timna toiv mibolav. Do not withhold goodness from its owner, from the one who could benefit from it. Be yois la'el yod chalasis. When you have the power to do, so you have the power to do good for somebody. Don't hold it back and be stingy and say I don't want to. So the Nitziv points out an interesting thing in one of his Trovis. He says, so why does the Gemara do it this way? Why does the Gemara first bring the paraphrase and say that there's no such pasuk, and then bring the actual pasuk? Just bring the actual pasuk to begin with. And he explains, because listen, Sefer Mishlei is not really takonis that are binding on everybody. It's etzes. It's advice from Shlomo HaMelech of how a yid should live. So if you only have the actual posik, al tim na tov mibolav, fine, it's eitz tova, kamashu on, be a good fellow. Doesn't mean it's something that you could be forced to. But therefore, the Gemara first paraphrased it, mi yos tov, al tikri ra, do not be called bad, which means, in other words, this is an actual takona that the Chachamim have the ability to enforce, that you should not be bad and prevent people from doing something where you're not losing and they stand to gain, and there's not even, like Marashah said about the Chotzer, the possibility that you might decide that you need this for something else. So it's an actual Takonas Chachamim, or it's an actual Takonah of Shlomo to not behave that way, and that Beis Din is empowered to enforce. In fact, he says, by the way, that this is, when you have the whole story, the famous story with the two women who came to Shlomo with the baby. Well, so what do you have? One of them said, cut up the baby, and the other one said, no. Then fine, give him to the other one. Shlomo actually applied this takana right there. Well then, al timna tovim ba'ol avos, v'yos la'el yod chalasis. You, the one who are saying, cut him up, what do you stand to gain from that? Nothing. So give him to the other one, he'imai. So he was using this as a basis, as a basis for that psak din that he said then, that the baby legitimately belongs to the mother who wants to keep him alive. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ogo'ola, Ei Cheshven. The neshama of Mashiach contains within it all the neshamas of the whole Jewish people. That is why, that's what gives him the power to redeem all Jewish people from Golos. As the Ramaz famously mentioned, on the Zohar that Mashiach is Yechida, he's the Yechida Klolus of all Jewish people, and therefore that's what gives him the ability to be Goyal, the whole Jewish people. Now, we know there are five levels of the Neshama. David HaMelech was Zoycha to Nefesh, Eliyahu to Ruach, Moshe Rabbeinu had Neshama, Adam Rishon had Chaya, and Mashiach will have Yechida. So all of them are Neshamas Klolus throughout history. Vice versa, every yid has a spark of Mashiach in him, namely, every yid has a yechida, and that yechida is a spark of the yechida klolus, which is embodied in Mashiach. Okay, continuing with halachas of Hashkamas HaBoker. So the last thing we learned was that you're not allowed to say Divrei Torah before you wash your hands, and then even then you should sit up first before you start saying them. Modani, you can say even before Negelbasen.
Say you're in an airplane, it's 5 in the morning, you don't want to wake up right next to you, so you look up at the outside, but you don't have to wash, instead of being Divrei Torah, you could learn without washing your hands.
You can speak without washing, yeah, you can speak Torah without washing your hands.
Then he said you could either learn. It shouldn't be Bitzel Torah.
Maybe, I don't know.
It'd wait 2 hours till the guy wakes up.
I hear. Okay. Okay. So now the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, if a person sleeps in his clothing, now, if he slept without clothing or without much clothing, then he may have touched parts of his body that are dirty or whatever, and that's why he has to wash Negelbasser. Here, if he slept in his clothing, he may well not have touched any such parts of his body. So then, in principle, then, such hands, he would actually be allowed to say Hashem's name with brachas and to say Divrei Torah, technically, according to the din of the Gemara and the Poskim. He certainly would be able at that point to touch his clothing before Netilas Yadayim, even though it's true there's a Ruach Ra on him. The only thing he shouldn't touch at that point is food and drink. But then, as Alter Rebbe goes on to say in the next piece, which we'll talk about tomorrow, Bez Hashem, that the Zohar says that he shouldn't. That the Medina de Gemara he'd be allowed to, again, because he slept in a way where it's unlikely that his hands touched things that would make his hands Tomei. So there's only the problem of Ruach Ra. But nevertheless, the Zohar says that he shouldn't be learning or touching his clothes or anything until he washes Negelbasser, which we'll expand more on that point tomorrow, Bez Hashem.